I had written an article on the greenhouse effect. It was a year-end article. They wanted me to pick out the most important scientific event of 1988. And I really thought that the most important scientific event of 1988 would only be recognized sometime in the future when you get a little perspective. But I thought that the most interesting scientific event of 1988 was the way everyone started speaking about the greenhouse effect just because there was a hot summer and a drought. So I explained what was meant by the greenhouse effect. And I also explained that not only were we constantly pumping carbon dioxide into the atmosphere because we're burning fossil fuels, coal and oil and gas, so that the content of the atmosphere, as far as carbon dioxide is concerned, has been going up steadily, not very rapidly, but steadily, ever since 1900. And it's continuing to do so. The amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere now is 50% higher than it was in 1900. It's still only a little over 0.035%, which is not enough to bother us as far as breathing is concerned, but it's enough to trap the infrared waves that Earth reflects into space and to raise the temperature of the Earth slightly. The temperature will keep on going up. And not only are we piling in more and more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but we are chopping down the forests of the earth at a great rate. And the forests themselves are the most efficient consumers of carbon dioxide that there are on earth. Anything that substitutes for the forests, like let us say grain fields or grasslands, are not going to consume carbon dioxide as efficiently. And if we replace them with desert, which is most likely, it won't absorb the carbon dioxide at all. So that, in a sense, we are contributing to the greenhouse effect in two ways. By pushing the output of carbon dioxide and inhibiting the input, so to speak. I said, therefore, when Brazil begins to cut down the rainforests of the Amazon, not only is it destroying a habitat for vast numbers of plant and animal life, which could be of great use to us, there are perhaps pharmacological products we know nothing about that are produced by these forms of life that if we knew about could advance the art of pharmacology and the practice of medicine enormously. And we'll never find out. We're going to drive them to extinction. We're going to destroy the ground because the soil of a rainforest isn't very good. And when you chop it down, it doesn't make for good farming. What it makes is for good deserts. And finally, we're going to cut down on absorbing the carbon dioxide and on producing oxygen so that we are actually tampering with the climate of the earth and with the very atmosphere that we breathe. So that under those circumstances, it is useless for Brazil to say that she can do what she wants with her own, that the rainforest belongs to her, and if she wants to cut them down, she can. The rainforest doesn't belong to her, it belongs to humanity. She is merely the custodian of the rainforest. I said that in the course of my article, and I got a letter in which a young man said, who gave the United States the right to tell Brazil what to do? What if Brazil says to us that we produce far more carbon dioxide than any other nation because we have more automobiles, we have more motors, we have more industry, and we are polluting the atmosphere far more on a per capita basis than anyone else on Earth? And therefore, why shouldn't they have the right to tell us to cut down on our industry, to clean up our pollution, instead of telling them not to cut down their forests? And I answered and said, you make a very good point. But now, look through my article and see where I said it was the United States who was supposed to make these decisions. I didn't say anywhere that it was the American right to police the world or to tell them what to do. And in fact, that gets to the nub of the whole point, that we are facing problems that transcend nations. That when we talk about the greenhouse effect, we're talking about something that affects not just the United States, not just Brazil. That affects the entire Earth for the worse. If the population goes up to the point where we destroy the resources of the Earth, it doesn't matter which nation is most populous, we all get it in the neck. If we have a nuclear war that produces a nuclear winter or a fallout that kills people everywhere, it doesn't matter who started the war, it doesn't matter at whom the nuclear bombs were aimed, we'll all get it. You can go through the entire list of dangers that face humanity, and the very point of the whole thing is that they face humanity and not any one section of it. And therefore, I might say in passing that this should be of peculiar interest to humanists. I have always thought that the reason we're called humanists is that we're involved with human beings as opposed to the supernatural, the existence of which is dubious at best. But if we are going to be interested in and involved with human beings, then I fail to see anything in the name that distinguishes between one set of human beings and another set. We are all human beings. If there's one thing that is biologically certain about the human species, is that it is a human species, one species. The similarities among us are enormous. The differences are trivial. That it is criminal for all of Earth now, not to be humanists, because now, when all human beings are facing the same problems, and these problems are life and death problems, they go to the root of the viability of the planet itself, and in order to solve these problems, in order to make sure not just that our progeny will be prosperous, that our progeny will be peaceful, but that our progeny will live. To go to the solution of these problems, we cannot expect that this will be done by individual nations. The only way we can solve a problem is by a human solution. A totally human solution, an international solution, a cooperative solution. It is important that the world get together and be sufficiently a unit to face the problems which attack us as a unit. The problems with the ocean, with the atmosphere, with the soil, with the population, with pollution, with anything you want to aim. Do not distinguish among us. How then can we distinguish among ourselves? There must be some way of getting together and of deciding not that the United States will tell Brazil what to do, not what Brazil will tell the United States what to do, but what the people of the earth will tell themselves they must do. We have no difficulty applying this principle to the United States itself. We don't say that New York hasn't got the right to tell California what to do, that California hasn't got the right to tell Florida what to do. When it comes to international trade, when it comes to any facet of national life that rises above the parochial needs of cities and states, the federal government tells all the states what to do, and the federal government can do it because it consists of representatives from all the states. Well, what we need is some sort of federal world government, and the only problem is how we manage to do that. Well, there are two ways in which this can be done, the carrot and the stick. Now, you'll notice that this is not something new that you've never heard of before. This is well known. Now, the stick is the fear of danger, the fear of destruction. And it works. It works fine. For 40 years now, for 40 years we've been engaged in a Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, which sometimes lightens up and sometimes grows more severe. I don't think, as I look back in history, that there has ever been a period of 40 consecutive years in which two nations have yelled at each other without their going to war in that interval of time. At least once, sometimes twice. They haven't. Not only have we not gone to war with the Soviet Union, we haven't even broken off relations. In other words, we not only don't dare fight, we don't even dare stop talking. This is a good thing, but why is it so? The answer is really there's nothing else they can do. There's no way in which we can really fight a war with the Soviet Union. It doesn't matter whether we hit them, or they hit us, or we hit each other. Whatever we do is going to destroy the earth. Obviously, the nations are going to cooperate, and as a matter of fact, they're doing it in more ways than they're willing to admit. We cooperate on the weather, for instance. We let each other have information needed for the weather. We let each other have information that we learn in space. And we cooperate in Antarctica. We cooperate in the high seas. We cooperate in many respects that we don't talk about. There's a lot of it being done, and more all the time. So that the stick is driving us to cooperation. But I always say, why try the stick alone? Why not the carrot as well? In United States history, we had both the stick and the carrot. After the end of the Revolutionary War, we had something we called the United States of America, but it wasn't. Each state was virtually independent. There was a Congress, but it had no powers. It couldn't even tax. It could only get voluntary contributions from the individual states who are always in arrears. Does that remind you of anything right now called the United Nations? Well, that's what the Articles of Confederation Congress was. It was a small version of the United Nations, and it was powerless. And the states were in constant trouble, and because they were afraid of the consequences of disunion, afraid we'd just be picked up by various European powers and go to war with each other, they set up the constitution by which the various states gave up some of their sovereign powers and embodied them in a federal government, and then voluntarily voted for that federal government and formed a true United States of America. So that was the stick, the fear of disunion. But where was the carrot? The carrot came after the Civil War. Now, the Civil War was a perfect case that we've seen a million times in human history of a settlement which doesn't settle. The Union beat the Confederacy, but the Confederacy put up one hell of a fight. It had no cause to be ashamed, and in fact, it felt it had lost only narrowly. And on top of that, the Union was vengeful, and we treated the Confederacy after its defeat as though we were an occupied foreign power, and the South wasn't likely to forget that. So you would expect that the South would always remember the Confederacy, not as it does with a kind of sentimental attachment, but powerfully, and would rebel every once in a while whenever it seemed that the occasion was right for it, and would be forever indulging in terrorism like the Basques in Spain. When were the Basques an independent power? Like the fighting between the two sides in Northern Ireland, like the fighting between the Shiites and everybody else in Lebanon. There'd be constant terrorism from the United Confederacy Brothers or something. And there isn't. There isn't. There was a healing somehow, and we became one nation again. And that was the workings of the carrot, because immediately after the Civil War came the period of the opening of the West, the development of the West, where the nation went west, founded new states, and anyone from any state could go to any part of the West, so that when a new state was developed, it consisted of people from all parts of the Union. The United States found its unity in a gigantic project that included all the states, and that made the differences between the states look small by comparison. It wasn't done, I think, out of intelligent purpose. It just happened. We were lucky. We had the carrot. Now, we need a carrot now. We need some other project so huge that it can only be done by all the nations of the world acting together to the best of their ability. We need a project so all-encompassing that we can manage to have all the various nations work at it and be glad to have it, something that would create something that all the nations could benefit from. And to me, the only candidate for it is this effort at space exploration. If we can establish space stations, if we can establish mining stations on the moon, if we can build power stations in space, if we can use energy directly from the sun, convert it into microwaves and beaming down to the Earth, we would finally have energy free of geography. We wouldn't have coal that existed in some nations and not in others, oil in which some nations were rich and others were poor. We wouldn't have forever to have the manufacturers exploit the agriculturalists or the raw material owners exploit those who need it, and so on. We would have something out in space that all contributed to and that reached all equally. Space would be equally reachable by all parts of the Earth. The energy that came down would go as easily to one part of the Earth as to another. Furthermore, if we did have power stations in space, they would require, I'm sure, constant maintenance, constant attendance, very difficult labors to keep them going. We would probably have to have large settlements in space. Any disturbance on Earth, anything that would keep the Earth from concentrating on space, would endanger the energy supply for the entire Earth. In other words, it would be immediately and obviously apparent to everyone on Earth that it would pay them to maintain a stable world order, because only so could their energy supply be maintained undisturbed. We would have the carrot there, a huge project that would please us all, that would lift us out of our narrow parochial concerns, that would give us something we couldn't have otherwise, a kind of prosperity and peace that we've never known before. And in going out, we can forget those little divisive effects that have made us suffer so long. I'm not any more idealistic than anyone else. I don't go around saying that human beings are going to love each other so much that they're going to set up a utopia. No. What I say is that if human beings have any sanity, enough sanity to fear the consequences of not doing it, and enough sanity to hope for the consequences of doing it, they will do it. But I can't guarantee that the human species will be sane. And if they are not, then we will probably destroy ourselves. We will certainly destroy civilization. We may destroy ourselves as a species. And who is going to fight that? Who is going to lead in the direction? Well, I hope lots of people, but I'm sure that among them will be the humanists, because by their very name, they celebrate humanity. They want humanity to survive, and they recognize that if they do survive, it will be by its own efforts. Never can we sit back and wait for miracles to save us. Miracles don't happen. Sweat happens. Efforts happens. Thought happens. And it's up to us to help have all that happen. Thank you very much.